Hello, listener. Welcome to the latest of an apparently never-ending series of podcasts called The Zeitgeist Tapes, in which Emma Burnell, say hello, Emma.
Hello, Emma.
Hello, Emma. That's, you know, you always say that. And me, Stephen Fielding, discuss usually a film, TV series, very occasionally a novel, which raises political issues of a wide and various type. And for this edition, we thought, or specifically Emma thought, it would be a very good idea to talk about the US TV series Mrs. America, which is being transmitted on BBC Two in the UK and is currently still on the iPlayer. And in order to help us discuss this series, we're joined by a guest, Helen Lewis, who is a writer for The Atlantic, whose newsletter, The Blue Stocking, to which you can subscribe, listener. She raised various issues about the series. And of course, she also wrote Difficult Women, which was published earlier this year, which is a history of feminism. So an actual expert. And on the Zeitgeist Tapes, we actually do take experts seriously. So
yeah, we've never had enough of experts.
No. So just for the sake of the listener, if he or she hasn't actually seen it yet, it is I think it's a 9-part series made in the US, which looks at both sides of the debate over the Equal Rights Amendment, which was passed by both houses of Congress in 1972. And as a consequence of the US Constitution, it had to be ratified, because it was changing the nature of the American Constitution to give equal rights to men and women. It had to be ratified by every single US state. So the series looks at both sides, those that opposed the ERA and those that wanted it to be taken on board by the American Constitution. And spoiler alert, in the end, the ERA is not passed by three states. So it doesn't actually become part of the United States Constitution, though it may do in the future, and we might want to talk about that. So Helen, you're the expert. You know what you're talking about in comparison to some other people here. What was your take on the series?
Yes, yeah, spoiler alert, sexism still exists. They didn't manage to solve it in the late 1970s. I thought I think it's a brilliantly structured series. So Davy Waller, who was the showrunner, came off Mad Men. And, you know, had a big writing team. And you can really see that in the structure of the episodes. And what she manages to do is invest historical moments with, I think you outlined it quite well, these much bigger cultural points that she makes. So, for example, she deals with lots of the things that are really big issues in the feminist movement at the time, like the relationship between, you know, women and marriage, women and monogamy. There's a whole episode that's all about, you know, what does it mean to be married to someone? Can you as a feminist be married to a man, and what should the terms of that be? You know, dealing with the fact that, you know, problems with both race and with lesbianism in the feminist movement at the time, through these kind of really iconic moments at a party, and a black woman who feels tokenized in the offices of Ms. Magazine, and of Betty Friedan, who called lesbians the lavender menace. But kind of in this, she's given a sort of slightly redemption arc. I mean, actually, she's of all the ways, I mean, they're all fairly difficult women, but I think Betty Friedan's depiction is the most interesting to me of the feminist side, because she is presented, you know, she is demanding, she is unreasonable, she is incredibly conscious of getting the credit for things that she's done, you know, sort of jealous. Whereas Gloria Steinem sort of drifts through it kind of all sort of hippy dippy in sunglasses, like a big aviator sunglasses, being kind of quite chill about stuff. You know, and Bella Abzug is presented as the kind of ultimate fixer, which I think is a really interesting thing as well to see. And you see Shirley Chisholm, who's the first black woman so far. I'm trying to think if anyone has ever tried to do it again, run for a major party platform in the US. And then set against them is Phyllis Schlafly, the model for Serena Joy in The Handmaid's Tale. You know, the woman who spent all her time saying that women should stay at home. And of course, the way that she's depicted here is fascinating. You know, a woman whose household entirely runs on maids. Her spinster sister does a load of the childcare with absolutely zero thanks. Her son is gay. And that's dealt with very beautifully, the fact that you know, she obviously knows and how she deals with that. And her relationship with her husband, who is kind of jealous of her, you know, of her celebrity, and wants to be top dog and kind of takes that out on her in various ways. I think it's a beautifully complicated character-driven portrayal of a political moment.
I mean, I think that's absolutely right. I think it would have been so easy to have painted this in very primary colours, you know, made these goodies and baddies. And the fact that they didn't do that, I thought was really, really well done. The fact that you can watch it, and as someone as passionately feminist as I am, and still have interest in and time for the Phyllis Schlafly character, and see, you not agree with her motivations, but understand them. And I think that's something that we're not very good at in the modern world, is understanding the motivations of the people we disagree with. So I thought it was really interesting that they managed to flesh her out that much and make her very human.
The origin story that they give her is very good. So she's actually not massively anti-feminist at all to start with. She's a defence policy analyst. She's a real hawk. And she goes into a meeting and she wants to talk to the senator about her, I think it's her views on Iran, isn't it, at that time?
Yeah.
And, you know, and first of all, she gets asked by one of them to take some notes. You know, they go, oh, you've got lovely handwriting. Why don't you take notes? And then, you know, people are sort of not really interested in her opinion until she pipes up something about how she thinks that the Equal Rights Amendment is a load of old nonsense. And suddenly you can see the expression on the senator's face change of like, oh, hello, this is quite cute. What would, you know, I don't want to look like an old dinosaur, but here's a woman arguing against the Equal Rights Amendment. And one of the strands that goes through this is the change in the Republican Party. So in the character of Jill Ruckelshouse, who's the only Republican in the National Women's Organization, you know, the idea that they were trying for bipartisan stuff on all of this, and how that would now be completely impossible because the Republican Party's gone off into the other side of a kind of culture war fringe. But, you know, it was very much seen as being like only a dinosaur would oppose this stuff. And actually, younger Republicans didn't want to be seen to oppose the ERA because that was so much where the zeitgeist was and where young voters were.
I mean, it's center. I mean, like all history. I mean, this is the kind of history that has some historians tearing their hairs out, because, of course, it starts off by saying some of this, you know, most of this is based on actual fact. And some of the people that, well, all the people that we've been talking about so far are real. But some of the rest of it isn't, and we've dramatised it. But like all history, however it's written, it's really about the present, isn't it, as much as anything else? And, I mean, you can sometimes see some little references that actually were there at the time, like there's the Reagan badge that says Make America Great Again and all of that. And the argument seems to be that this battle between these women over the ERA is actually part of that wider configuration, which I think Helen sort of mentioned, that we are now dealing with today, the culture wars, it seems to be suggesting to me. And the way in which that kind of bipartisanship, because it's the ERA was supported by Nixon. I mean, it's like, we all think Richard Nixon was the heart of darkness.
No, woke Richard Nixon, who knew?
Yes, Richard Nixon was in favour of it. I mean, Phyllis Schlafly, who, I mean, I have to say, I mean, I'm not an expert in American politics, so but I've never heard of her. I mean, I'd not heard of her. Now I know quite a bit about her, thanks to the series and whatever. I mean, she basically was a kind of force of nature and mobilised women, middle-class women, very comfortably off women, but women across the United States, out of Washington, to oppose the ERA, which otherwise very probably would have passed through all the various state legislatures, very likely.
She had some incredible weapons on her side, though, and I think that the idea of the draft, right, the idea that you get a certain number of people are selected for the military every year, was incredibly helpful to her, because, of course, women were excluded from it. And the idea was, you know, oh, do you really want equal rights if that means you're going to have to get sent off to Vietnam? And, of course, you know, that's something that still comes up now. And I think if we ever did return to any kind of national service, it would be a massive issue here. Like, obviously, some countries like Israel, that absolutely applies now, and it's men and women. But at the time, and I still think now, people, you know, there's lots of people who are very resistant about the idea of sending women to war. So that was a kind of really good thing that she mobilized. She did the kind of classic politician thing of finding the kind of couple of questions you can poke it, the kind of, you know, things you can jam into the spokes that really brought people up. And you know, it's symptomatic of that difficult transition that feminism had to make from saying we want to be treated exactly the same to actually our lives are different, our bodies are different, sometimes we want to be treated differently. So there were lots of things of like, aha, do you really want to be treated exactly the same? And you can see the birth of that kind of more nuanced argument coming through. The other thing it does politically, which I think is really interesting, is it shows the birth of you know, or the addition of abortion rights, pro-life activism into that sort of stew, like the creation of the so-called moral majority. And the way that it's depicted in the show is Phyllis Schlafly's got her mailing list, and then she sees it as a sort of another, there's a rival. She's kind of like eyeing up the competition. And it's this woman who is much more extreme in her views, certainly, you know, is depicted in the show as being pretty much just as flat out racist. Mm. But is also very much of that, what about protecting the little babies? And the kind of great irony of this is that we know from the research that actually women are slightly more anti-abortion than men. And particularly you get, you know, lots of mothers who are stay-at-home mothers who are living traditional lifestyles who are incredibly anti-abortion. And for them, the argument is about protecting children and like what, you know, what how motherhood gives you an identity and how that's a special calling. And so it shows that kind of how all that movement kind of coalesced together, which I thought was also really interesting.
Mm. I mean, I noticed something on the Daily Telegraph was having had a story recently about the clothes and Mrs. America. So obviously audiences take different things. And I wondered, because I watching it, I mean, obviously the people who made the show, they have their own particular view, right? But the way in which they presented the Phyllis Schlafly and her grassroots movement, they were kind of sort of like, sometimes like presented like the Davids, like the ordinary Davids against the Goliath of these cosmopolitan women with their who were always smoking really cool, long cigarettes, going to discos, you know, in New York and all of that. And there was no sense, although there was reference to how the Schlafly movement was funded by the Ku Klux Klan and special interests and all these people. We never saw that. I mean, that was sometimes an accusation, but it was never followed through. I don't know the extent to which that was actually true. But there was this kind of sense that these were little home mums against these big media types, which kind of almost falls into the same trope about progressives and conservatives today. I just wondered if you were picking up on that.
I think so. And I think it also falls through this hilariously the same thing I was thinking about, that sort of the way these arguments play out on Twitter now about whatever you want to call them, cancel culture, wokeness, Brexit, culture wars divides. In that what actually you end up is a load of people saying, oh, you left-wing elites are so out of touch with the population. And that accusation is generally levelled by right-wing elites.
Yes.
Right. So what you do is get a kind of argument by people who are all on Twitter, who are almost by definition elite, right? Very few of the British population are on it. It skews much whiter, more educated, wealthier, like everything than the population as a whole. Arguing about who really represents the authentic voice of the people. Mm-hmm. And that is exactly what you see here. Who represents the authentic voice of the American woman? Is it Gloria Steinem with her long hair and her cigarettes and her kind of cool, you know, desire not to have kids and have lots of different relationships? Or is it Phyllis Schlafly and her very middle-class suburbanite sensibility? And that contest has never been really solved. And it will never be solved for as long as the fact that feminism is still a middle-class and university-educated movement. You know, ABC One women, university graduate women, are much more likely to describe themselves as feminists than the population as a whole. So that is a tension that still exists today.
It's also very interesting to me that at this point, they've made this show to celebrate second wave feminism, which is almost completely out of fashion, as far as I can tell. Even amongst most feminists, there's very little kind of... there's not always a paying of the debt that we owe to the women who came before us. So I think this has been a really useful rebalancing of that. Mm. And you're looking at women who were, you know, in today's terms would be quite complicated, like Betty Friedan, and, you know, her attitude towards sexuality very much not sort of fitting into the modern zeitgeist. But it's important that we understand the fights that people had before us.
Oh, I agree with you. I think there's an astonishing amount of complacency, not just in feminism, but all the way across modern day life. I mean, it's something I talked about a lot when I was doing interviews for Difficult Women. And actually, you see it in the kind of pandemic response or America's response to Donald Trump. Well, of course, a country like America could never slide into authoritarianism. Well, of course, we could never be hit with a pandemic. We've got modern medicine now. Well, of course, you know, the water that comes out of my tap doesn't poison me, you know, all of this stuff. And of course, women should get paid the same. I mean, I wrote about the Alvino case in my book, and which is 1982. And at that point, women, you know, the Sex Discrimination Act has been passed, and yet you get the situation in which women don't get served at a bar. And I think if you said that to a 19-year-old now, by the way, do you know, just outside my lifetime, there was women couldn't get served at a bar. It was like a, you know, pretty much a situation comparable to, you know, apartheid or the civil rights era, that it had to protest in order to be able to spend their money in the same way as men. It's extraordinarily overt discrimination, never mind all the subtler sexism that goes on. And that is, you know, that is within the last 40 years. So I agree with you, Emma. I think one of the great things that the show does is it shows how much shit the second wave got done.
Yeah.
Actually what it cost them to do it. And yes, absolutely, they made mistakes. But I think, you know, which is why I think that the episode with Shirley Chisholm is really brilliant, actually. So she decides to run for president.
She was incredible.
Yeah, and it's a great performance by Uzo Aduba as well. But the way that she is constant, and she faces a lot of things that happen now, right? So she's still asked to choose between being, is she primarily a black candidate or is she primarily the women's candidate? And if you're going to alienate the average voter who is presumed to be a white man, you know, which one of those comes first? So you end up with the women's movement kind of being a bit tense about her as a black woman, and then the civil rights movement a bit tense about her being a woman. And I thought that, you know, and the wrestling that that Bella Abzug and Gloria Steinem do about whether or not you just continue to support her on her doomed quest. And I think they were probably right to assess it was a doomed quest, given that, you know, it was only 4 years ago that the US refused to elect a female president that had previously been married to another president that had fundraised an incredible amount of money, had the entire support of the entire Democratic machine behind her. I can only imagine what Shirley Chisholm faced. But, you know, and then throw their lot in with another candidate in the hope of getting stuff from him. But the big lesson of all of it, and actually it's a lesson that I think Phyllis Schlafly discovers as much as a second wave feminist, is without a seat at the table, you're a beggar. You're begging for scraps. And that's why I love the ending, which is so bittersweet for Schlafly. You know, she gets the candidate she wants. She's been helped by him. And then she gets completely screwed over by Reagan, who doesn't give her a place in his cabinet. And she has essentially at that point learned the lesson of second wave feminism, which is you're not equal unless you're being treated as good as a man.
But do you think, because I mean, I thought it was really good, because political dramas are really bad at showing political discussions about the need to balance different kinds of interests, different kinds of sensibilities. And the series, particularly in the women's movement side of things, was very, very good. You know, like you're saying, you know, are you a woman? Are you black? Are you lesbian? How do we reconcile all these different things? But what I thought it was kind of traditional, i.e. quite bad at presenting the party context. So you, as you say, at the very end, Schlafly gets shafted by Reagan. She's done all this work for him. He gets elected and there's no job for her. In the same way that Bella Abzug gets shafted by Carter, because she, you know, she wants to have a meeting which is longer than 15 minutes to discuss 2 years of work by the committee that she was chairing for women. And then he sacks her because he doesn't want to be seen, as is explained, that, you know, Carter doesn't want to be seen that he's being run by women because he doesn't want to look weak. But Reagan, the interesting thing about Reagan is when he says he's dropping Schlafly, she's getting no cabinet job, is that, well, I've got a problem with women, right? And if he puts her in the cabinet, she's very anti-feminist and he's afraid, presumably, that she's going to put off those kind of centre ground women who hadn't voted for him in 1980, in the same way that Carter wanted these men who didn't want, you know, him to be looking, you know, like he was being run by women to vote for him, or maybe women who were more conservative. So I mean, it seemed like that they were kind of presenting the two parties as just, you know, run by men, and it was unreasonable. And yet, in some ways, it was kind of reasonable, because what they were doing is that they were addressing the character who I think is the most interesting character, the one that's presumably completely made up, Alice, who starts off being Bella's friend, and not Bella's, but starts off being the kind of close confidant of, yeah, of Phyllis.
First raises the ERA with Phyllis, and then Phyllis.
Yes, yeah, and she, you know, she's a Catholic like Phyllis is, and she's a bit timid, but she gets into the movement, and then she goes on a journey, doesn't she? And she, when she goes to Houston, this big conference, National Women's Conference, she takes a tablet and takes too much to drink, and then she kind of starts a little journey where she sees that Phyllis is just too much. And Phyllis is a bit of a hypocrite, because Phyllis isn't, she's all kind of about saying women don't, you know, when the friend Pamela, she's really been abused, she just says, well, you just have to take it from your husband, you know, there's no solution to it. So she starts to question things, and she ends up getting a job, doesn't she? So I don't know, it raises a kind of interesting issue.
But don't you like that though? I mean, I know, yes, you say they ignore, yeah, the, but I think that that's in the same way that I think in the Shirley Chisholm. Oh, hold on. Yeah, I think in the same way in the Shirley Chisholm episode, there isn't an obvious villain and a hero. It's not like, and they were bad for dumping the first black woman candidate. You, yeah, see, yeah, entirely Shirley Chisholm's point of view, but you also see entirely the point of view that says, it's never going to happen. Let's actually concentrate our resources on a candidate we think might win. And it, which is what politics always feels like, at least when I've ever covered it, is that people choosing between several terrible options and, yeah, lots of quite, you know, usually quite good people, trying to make a 15-1-49 decision rather than these very simple stories of someone being a hero or a villain.
Oh, no, that's absolutely. Yeah. But before we continue that thought, we usually have a clip, and because I mentioned Alice goes to Houston to protest against all these feminists, but she goes on a little journey. She gets a bit woozy. And she's starting to become a bit discontented with the hardliners in her own movement. And she ends up going to a feminist meeting where they're all singing the Woody Guthrie song, This Land Is My Land. And they have a nice, interesting conversation, which maybe sort of sums up what maybe the series is trying to suggest, or one of the things. This land was made for you and me. Nobody living can ever stop me as I go walking that freedom highway. Nobody living could ever make me turn back. This land was made for you and me. This land is yours.
Home. I learned it with all my kids when they were in school.
Woody Guthrie wrote it.
Oh, he's a poet.
He's a socialist.
Come on. Don't be ridiculous.
You were up there belting out a Marxist song.
Oh, no, no, no. It's patriotic.
So I thought it was, they're clearly making a point, or what is that point? When she sings it, she thinks it's a patriotic song, and she's then told, well, actually, it's a Marxist song, it's a socialist song. And are they saying something that, well, they're all singing the same song, but they're kind of understanding it in different ways, or am I reading too much into that?
I mean, that makes sense that people come to feminism from a lot of different angles. And there are always lively discussions within feminism about how much of it you have to buy into in order to call yourself a feminist. You know, every 5 years we have the discussion about, can you be a Tory and a feminist, or is it an inherently left-wing point of view because it's about equality? You know, and I think that it, unfortunately, sadly for me, because I would like it to be me, there is no ultimate high priest of feminism who gets to make rulings on that, which is, again, one of the things that the series does well, is representing how fractured a movement is, and actually how it's really difficult because it involves both personal relationships inevitably and political decisions, and it's, you know, and it's impossible to do the thing that you're supposed to do, which is kind of keep, you know, two entirely separate and just say whatever's best for the work, because people do get jealous, or they do take against someone who said something rude about them 3 years earlier. And I think that's where Betty Friedan's character is such a good catalyst for that, because she's so, you know, she's such an obvious celebrity that Feminine Mystique was just a huge bestseller. And yet she became the one that the next generation of feminists kind of needed, because she'd got all that star power, but they all kicked against. And Gloria Steinem went through a similar thing where they needed her because she was glamorous, incredibly sexy and, you know, and cool. But of course that meant lots and lots of people hated her because they felt, well, look, you know, she's just traded on her looks to get here. And I love that they didn't shy away from that without making you sort of hate them all as kind of mean-spirited and vicious.
No, and even Betty Friedan, who I think probably had the harshest, I suppose, depiction, you know, you can kind of at every point you could see where she was coming from and why she was and I suppose in some ways it's really interesting, again, coming back to that second wave thing. And I suppose she was the first wave and they were kicking against the kind of feminism that she'd originally raised. And it is just a constantly iterative process. But we're so black and white so often now. And what I really loved about this was that we really looked at the complexities of these people. We saw, you know, where they weren't perfect. We saw where they weren't well-behaved. We saw where they were hypocrites or going against what they thought were their moral values throughout. And that's what makes them human. And that's what made the drama a drama rather than just a historical picture.
And I think it's very easy now to paint Betty Friedan as a homophobe and just see that that's what it was about. But I think it's also about something I'm sure, Emma, you'll be familiar with from your time in the Labour Party trenches, about worrying that you looked radical, that you were alienating the centre ground. And actually, how do you sell feminism in the 70s to people who are very traditional, who thinks that marriage is only between a man and a woman, and, you know, it's God's will, and all that kind of stuff. And I think that was as much as anything what her concerns over lesbian feminism were. And just because I think that, you know, she was discriminatory, it doesn't mean that that wasn't, as a political calculation, a kind of astute and well-supported one.
Yeah, and I mean, what was fascinating was the arguments about what Houston should be, whether it should be this huge, as Gloria Steinem wanted, this sort of huge jamboree of every single issue under the sun, or whether it should be very pointed and just about sort of the ERA and feminism. I thought that, you know, and that is the constant tension, isn't it? You know, do we cover everything badly or do we do one thing well?
God, I mean, that episode really brought me out in hives. Just seeing those arguments about people, basically when you try and organise anything in feminism and someone turns up because it's like the thing that they're going, oh, I see, what about the X, right? And it's like kind of feminism hipsterism. And I've written about this in the book. I think when you say stuff like that, people kind of accuse you of being whatever it might, you know, white, middle class, blah, blah, not interested in outsider issues. But I think there's a real difference that it's hard to kind of keep an eye on between people who turn up with a genuine, well-founded critique because they want to help you become a better activist and people who just like standing on the sidelines to go, well, of course, had I organised this conference, it would have been perfect. Regrettably, I was not put in charge. And I thought, you know, that's why that episode really, I mean, I think I probably would have taken several wines and a pill if I had to be there, because you just imagine organising anything like that, it would have been, which they bring out again, right, particularly in the debates about abortion. How do you find a line on abortion? You know, is that the issue that if you're going to get one thing, you want to get that? And obviously to Steinem, it is. And there's a great scene which is taken from her memoir about her being in Europe and getting at the time illegal abortion, and the doctor saying, you know, promise me two things. One, you won't tell anyone I did this, and two, go and live your life, right? I'm giving you back the chance to have a different kind of life. Make sure you make the most of it. And so it was obviously for her, it was an absolutely essential part of women's freedom. But again, it's another issue that was really alienating to a lot of people and lost feminists a lot of support for more, you know, work-based stuff or childcare-based stuff.
So I don't know if we've kind of talked ourselves up, but we're near our listeners' limit, I think, possibly. But so I would just like to sort of just sum it up, just because the series, even if you're not interested in feminism, this is a really, really interesting way of looking at political action, in dramatised in a very clever, very funny way with a great soundtrack, but also takes you to issues that... are still, well, clearly this is why they've made it, are clearly still with us. Joe Biden, I Googled just now, is committed to implementing the Equal Rights Amendment, which has now been ratified, as it makes it clear at the very end of the series, has now been ratified by all states, although a few states have de-ratified it if they can, so it's all a bit complicated. But this whole thing may be starting again, albeit 40 50 years after,
but also he's committed to he's committed to a female vice president. And actually, yes. If it's Kamala Harris or Susan Rice, it might very well be a woman of colour, which would be, you know, and also because he's hinted that he might be a one-term president, that sets up the next person as a,
yes.
you know, I mean, I unfortunately, having watched this, I did come away thinking that if there is a woman president, I sort of suspect she'll be Republican and I suspect she'll be an anti-feminist. And it made me want to go away, actually. And I've spent a couple of weeks reading British stuff from the late 1970s, because I think there's a really interesting similar dynamic here, which is who is the huge beneficiary of all this work that's done to get women into politics, to get women's voices heard, to demolish the barriers? Oh, look, it's Margaret Thatcher.
Yeah.
Who is elected in 1979 in an election which dramatically reduces the number of women in parliament overall. Mm. So, you know, the great battlers of the late 60s and early 70s, like Barbara Castle, never managed to make it over the line. But the person who does make it over the line is the person who believes in individualism and who doesn't describe themselves as a feminist. And that, to me, is fascinating. In the same way that, like, when you lose, you win. And I think the Labour feminists of the 1970s, you know, they lost, but they won by getting a... All they'd ever wanted was a female prime minister. And then the one they got was Margaret Thatcher.
Yes. Anyway, history isn't a prison. It is there to be changed. At least I must have said that in a lecture at some point. It just now behoves me to thank Emma Burnell for contributing to our discussion, and to Helen Lewis. Thank you very much, Helen, for...
Thank you for having me.
Your time. And I've got to remind our listener, yet again, I mean, I think you'd have got it by now, but this is a Political Human production. Will you rate and review on whatever platform you may be listening to this, so we know what you think about it. And to finally thank Lord Stuart Wood of Anfield for writing the theme tune.